Hello? Can you hear me okay? Sounds good? Can you hear me in the back? Is that good? Okay. And two screens, you can see this, right? Okay, good. So first off, my concerns about the recording program on Wednesday were founded. I can't seem to get the recordings off my phone without installing a program on Windows that will listen on some random port, and then I have to connect to it over Wi-Fi. And it's just, I don't know what that program is. So I'm going to have to install, so this weekend I'm going to install it in a virtual machine at home that I can then dispose of and try to get the recordings out. So hopefully I will have the recordings up tomorrow. I am trying a different program now that I think works better. We will see. I'm not, but yeah, we will see. Okay, good. Still recording. So this little blurb here about the so this is assignment one. It's now up. When I say it's not finalized, I want to do a last debugging check to make sure I didn't miss anything. But otherwise, I think it's good. So you can start working on it now. I'm going to put up the See You Learn assignment. Thing for you to submit it. So it's due January 29th, I believe, which is a week from, so basically 10 days from now. Now, for those of you who have gone to tutorial, you've already started on the assignment because the assignment is based on form demo. So have not wasted your time. So I just want to spend a couple of minutes before going on and talking about, we might end up spending the entire class talking about this. We'll see how it goes. See what questions I get from you all. But the idea is that in the tutorial for this week, I've given you a simple Node application that has you submit a form and it stores the information from the form on the server, and then it lets you play with it. And so you have to make some modification extensions. So in part A, what I want you to do is delete and modify lines, mainly delete, and tell me what happens to the application when you do this. Now, the one thing is be careful. The changes sometimes are obvious, and sometimes the changes are not so obvious. So make sure it's clear, you understand what the change is and what it did. And then in part B, you need to do some coding, make some simple changes. This change right here is basically what you did in the tutorial. And then you're going to have to answer some questions in more detail, more abstractly. So what I wanted to spend time today was going through this code and going through a bit of Node and Jade and talking about very concretely these different pieces and what they're all doing. There's a lot of different layers and pieces to keep track of. And I find in tutorial I kind of see where you're all having problems with these different parts. I'm going to try explaining some of that now. I'm going to try not using the board. My instinct is to use the board. I will not use the board. Instead, I will use my web. Putty web. No. Okay. I think I just need to get a laptop that I'll bring into class. Okay. Why is it not asking about security updates? Anyway, and let's make this change settings, appearance. Okay. So if you want to do examples, we've got that there. Otherwise, as I have something to type on. As you might have guessed from my the way I set up the virtual machine, I like Emacs. I didn't realize some of you liked Vim quite so much, so I'm going to update the virtual machine to have Vim in it. I need to do some other tweaks to it, so hopefully that will go out next week, but I need to, because I know a lot of you like it. But. Okay, you really like gedit? The trouble with gedit, it depends on all these GNOME libraries. I'll have to see how much space it takes up. I was trying originally to go for smaller, but take requests. Certainly gedit is, gedit actually has certain good features, so I'll look into it. So, okay, so let's go. Feature requests. Requests for VM. Vim. Gedit. Any other requests? Okay. Think of some.
Solutions.
What?
Assignment solutions.
Add them. There are assignment solutions for last term. Go through them. Yes?
There's no instructions about running the VM. It says you have to log off. But
oh.
I've never seen that log
off. Okay. So I made things convenient and had it automatically log in on boot. But you can actually log out and change users. So I should, okay, I should update the wiki. I forgot I did that.
Well, you don't have to change it.
Wait, no. Okay. These are things good to know. So anyone want to, so I'm going to see what I can do with taking, these might end up being notes suitable for the wiki, but I need someone to add notes to the wiki for today. Remember, I was offering extra credit for this. Anyone wants to volunteer? Okay, thank you. Great. Send me email to say volunteer so I can give you credit. Thank you. And then the TA, one of the TAs will be checking on you to make sure that it gets entered properly. Thanks. So what did I want to talk about today? So what I want to talk about was some of the pieces that you have when you're programming in the Node environment. So one thing, so let's talk about some of these things. There's Node, there's Jade. You can see all this in the back, right? Do I need to, okay, good, okay. So there's Node, there's Jade, Bootstrap, jQuery, if you looked at it a little closely. And there's HTML somewhere in there, and HTTP. So when you're looking at these, at this code here, you have to keep in mind all these different pieces. So app.js, so you should think that, well, app.js, that's the program that I type, I say node, and I say app.js. So that's probably code for node. You know node runs a JavaScript interpreter, so a JavaScript runtime, so this is JavaScript. Okay, app.js is JavaScript. So it's got all these calls here, comments, whatever. But then, how do the other files first fit into this application? So the first thing you should always look is at the top, well, at these require lines. Whenever you see a require line, this is a reference to Node's module system. I mentioned this a bit last time, but this is the Node module system in action. So you've got a require line, and then it refers to a name. Now, if there is no path in front of it, if it's just a name, it searches in the Node standard locations for modules, and also in the node modules directory. Specifically, when you say require express, it expects that there is a directory, either in the standard modules that come with node, or in your node modules directory, there is a directory there called express, or a JavaScript file called, actually if it just doesn't have .js, it's a directory. So there's a directory there, and inside that directory, it expects a file called index.js. So let's test this. Okay, so actually no. No, let's keep that there. We'll do everything in Emacs. Form demo. So this is form demo. So if you look in here, we have this, you know, we have the other files, we have node modules. In node modules, you'll see there's a directory called express. And in express, you'll see there's a file called index.js. And you see it loads stuff. But when we say it loads it, what are we actually doing? Is it that all the code is now accessible in that JavaScript file and whatever else it loads? No. It's all going to be in a separate environment. And what you can access is what you assign here. This var express means that something that this returns will be assigned here, specifically an object will be returned from this normally, and then that's assigned to express here. Now the object that is returned is the exports object. So if you look here, we have a line here, routes equals require dot slash routes. So that means the current directory, look for the directory routes and load index.js in it. So down here we've got routes index.js, and in it we have two functions that are both named exports. So it's exports.index, exports.add. We now have, so that's why we assign them to exports, is because that means that will be part of the export that will be returned. So that means when we go back to here and we say routes equals this, this means routes now is an object. That object has two properties, add and index. And that's why we can then later refer to routes.index and routes.add. Those two these two references here come from this here. That's what they're talking about. Exports.index is routes.index. It's very important you understand that, otherwise you won't get the modules, you won't be able to follow the code. Good. Now, remember how we talked about node being asynchronous? That means it doesn't sit there and it doesn't block when your code is. It sort of runs and then waits and stuff. So this has very important implications about understanding this file. In particular, when does this code get executed? When, specifically, what, when does line 42 finish and then and this file terminates? When does that happen?
User request for a page that requires a JavaScript.
Is that, so you're saying this file gets invoked when the user requests a page that requires some more JavaScript code to run?
Of that JavaScript.
Requires this JavaScript run. Any other opinions?
When it's done listening.
When it's done listening. So, kind of. So one test you might want to try later, which I'm pretty sure how it works. Well, actually, we can test this. Although I can't access. Well, I could. I don't want to try that right now. The thing to understand is this file logically finishes when you start up the web app, when you start up the web server. It basically terminates. You've executed all the code in here. Nothing is run after like the first, you know, few fractions of a second when this is evaluated. After that, this file isn't doing anything. I go, what? And that's because the purpose of this file is to set up the web server. Not to do any work. It's to set things up. And these are probably the two most important lines to understand in this file, is app.get and app.post. Remember I said that there are two main
two main types of requests in HTTP, gets and posts. So when we say app.get and app.post, we're defining what a specific get and a specific post request will do. It's saying when the web server gets a get request for slash, run routes.index. When it gets a request for app.post, for a post request for slash add, run routes.add. But all you're doing here is registering these as callbacks. These lines run once and they're never run again. The functions that are registered run every time those pages are requested. This is the key distinction to understand. This file terminates. This is done. Once you start that create server, once you call the listen thing, that basically starts an infinite loop. That infinite loop is deep inside Node. It's going to sit there and wait for incoming requests on that socket on port 3000 or whatever it ends up being, because it's been said to be something different at runtime. It'll be sitting there waiting forever on that port, waiting for data comes in. And when data comes in, it will then examine it and run whatever handlers are appropriate. And then go back to waiting. So I said these lines, 3600, only run when the web server first starts up. This is basically configuration. And then these functions, index and add, get run specifically whenever a request comes in. So I said there are these gets and posts that are being handled. Are these the only gets and posts that the server can potentially handle? No? So let me put it this way. When you access the hello world one you did in the first tutorial, there was the main, but then you disabled the CSS. There was a style sheet that was associated with the page. And you actually, in the tutorial, got rid of that style sheet so it wasn't loaded. And then you got the old, Times Roman font stuff, and it looked all ugly. What was being loaded was another file from the web server. It was doing an HTTP get for the style sheet. Specifically, when you have something like this layout, and you have these script equals source, vendor jQuery JS, script this, link this, these are defining, these are causing the web page to make additional get requests for resources from the server. So just like our slash, we honored that get request, we're also honoring get requests for these URLs. But we didn't add a specific route for them. We did not make a line for them. If those were handled in the same way as these, you would have to add a specific line saying app.get, and you have to have a file, and you have to have a function, and that function would read the file and then return it. But we don't have to do that. So where are those gets being handled?
Modules.
So some other part of Node's handling. Now the beautiful thing about Node is that while there's a lot of machinery underneath it, almost nothing happens without some notice to you. This code tells you everything that is happening. Everything is a result of a specific line in here. If you don't have any code in here, Node basically does nothing. You just get a basic read-eval print loop. It doesn't do anything else. Everything is triggered by lines in this code. So what I'm really asking is which line is responsible for making sure we can access those style sheets and those extra JavaScript files that will be loaded on the client by get requests.
So first off, look, what we should do is look in, where are those files? I should just keep this up. So we're in form demo here. If we go to, so if you know, we know it's in views. That's the J file. We know it's in routes. Those things. It, user.js does nothing, by the way, right now. Public vendor bootstrap. So you notice the vendor stuff is all in public. Any references to public in this file? On line 29. Right? So if you see, there's this thing, this app use. So this use syntax is saying for it to use some bit of code, basically, at a module. This is something as part of the Express framework. They've built up all these modules, and they've given you a standard way of using them. So one of the modules it's using is this express.static. And then the only argument to it is this, this path join, your name, public. So path comes from the path module. Any thoughts on what path might do? Path names? You all know what a path name is, right? Yeah, well, when I say a path name, I'm just saying like a directory. And it turns out that directory is the path for them. There's different syntax for them on different platforms. Right? You know, Windows uses backslashes, Unix uses forward slashes and stuff. Old school Mac used colons. So here's a little bit of abstraction. What they're saying is instead of just concatenating the strings together, join the path together. I want to have this on the end of the path. I want public. And then, and what's this dir name? This is the directory where the node code is, where app.js is. Say, take this current directory and access the public subdirectory. So, current directory slash public, give that to express.static. So now the question is, what does express.static do? What kind of module is it?
Mm-hmm. I have a question regarding the dir name.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it hidden with the uses the hidden semantics or whatever?
Why is the hidden semantics?
If it has two underscores in front of it, that means it's hidden.
Because it's, I mean, a lot of times environment configuration is put in these kind of hidden variables. And the real reason you put these two slashes in there, and these underscores there, is because you just want to make it so that programmers don't normally pick these names. In regular code, you might want to refer to a dir name. You won't normally refer to underscore dir name. So it's, and more than it being hidden, it's just it's out of your namespace.
Okay,
that's all. It's just a convention.
I was wondering, because like, wouldn't you use some kind of, I don't know, function or something that seems more better for the reader instead of something that's hidden from the reader, that's supposed to be hidden?
Why, okay, so why not access a, why isn't this a function call instead of a, so the thing in JavaScript, in order to have that, in order to have it be a function, it would have to also be a global name. And so it's really six of one, half dozen the other. The only thing that's going to do is return a string. You're just invoking a function call just to get a string when you already have to access that symbol anyway. You already have to take up one. It doesn't buy you anything. In another language, you might say, oh, I've got a compiler to take out these things and stuff. But in a language like JavaScript, it's like, well, why have an efficiency and it doesn't buy you anything? So, but yeah, so here's what this is express.static. Any thoughts on what it is? This is Apache. That line is a static web server, i.e. it serves files. By adding this line to your application, you essentially have the base functionality of a system like Apache, which is anything in public now can be accessed by a GET request.
You have to know the specific name. We haven't done anything to allow you to do directory traversal, because by default you don't want to allow that. But you could add a module to enable that. But here, all these files, everything in here, like if I wanted to have some images to add to the page, I could stick them in the images directory. I don't have to put it in the images directory. I could just put it in the top level. If I don't like this directory public, I could say web server. I mean, it's all configuration. This is just a framework. You can make it whatever you want. This is just convention.
But it all starts with this line here.
One thing to keep in mind is the ordering of lines here is important. In particular,
the fact that this stuff comes first, saying the view engine, where is the router? Yeah, having the router this as late, then having this there is you're basically saying that if there's any files that are there that have paths that are the same as explicit routes that I've declared, the ones that I've declared will take precedence. You can't stick a file in slash public and have that all of a sudden. Like if I create a file called add, actually calls it, or just I put an index.html in the top level thing, it won't use it. Does that seem clear? So you start up Node, run this. Okay, now after this file is executed, it's now set up what functions are going to be invoked every time a request comes in. Now we have these requests. We have the GET request for particular files. That happens now transparently. And then we have these two specific things, a GET for slash and a POST for add. That invokes these two functions here. These two functions, you'll notice, all take two arguments, and req and response. So request and response. So req is an object that represents the incoming GET request or POST request to the server. So that's the HTTP request that came in from the client is represented as an object here. And the response will be the object that represents the returning web page. So if you want to, you put the web page into response, and then Node will send it back to the client. So when you see things that say res.render, we're saying that we want to generate the response for the we want to generate the response page, and we have this method here called render, which takes these arguments. We are exactly creating an object on the fly, yes. That's exactly what this is. This is an object right here with one property, title, and one value. Here, we're creating an object on the fly that has two properties. The reason why you're doing this as an object is, in effect, you want to encapsulate arbitrary numbers of things, name value pairs, that are going to be sent as an argument to this res render call. So what's this index and add string referring to in these res render calls? What are those? The name of a function. Nope. They're the name of a file that ends in .j. This is the reference to the JADE files. So when you go here, index.jade and add.jade, we just called them right here. This is add.jade, this is index.jade. Why are they .jade? Why aren't they something else? Well, we told Node that they should end in .jade. We told Node that because up here we said our view engine is Jade. By saying the view engine, that means when we call res render, the engine that's going to be used to convert whatever file we give, what's the templating engine we're using?
going to use it to generate HTML, that will be J files, because we said that.
Now you might ask, okay, so Jade is this templating engine. Why do I have a templating engine? What's this template thing? Why isn't this just HTML?
Mm-hmm.
So Jade has certain syntactical niceties. It also has some syntactical quirks. You know, it's sensitive to white space and stuff, but that's part of it. But that's not quite good enough. Is it something else that's very important? Like, why not just have it directly be HTML? Why do you want it to go? Why do you need this intermediate step? Because we're just rendering pages, right? So the thing to remember for this web server is we want to generate dynamic pages. That's the whole point of this exercise. If I want static pages, I just put the HTML in a file. I put it in public and it's served up. I'm done. When I'm putting in programmatic control, I want to dynamically generate the page. And the question is, how do I specify what the page is going to look like? The point of a template engine is to make it easier to dynamically create pages. And part of understanding that is that parts of your page are going to be have static, you know, patterns. Some your pages are going to have common patterns, like you're going to have potentially the same header on all the same pages. You want to abstract that out so you aren't having to enter that every time. And then you want some ways of doing, you know, changing the content. You might want to replicate certain portions. You might want to do variable substitution in, or do other, manipulate what would be generated. Now, there are a number of HTML templating languages which look mostly like HTML. In fact, or that they're really embedded inside of it. In fact, things like PHP were originally designed this way. When you write a PHP program, you would write an HTML page, and inside of it, you would say, oh, this is a PHP part. And you have a PHP tag begin and end, and you put your PHP code inside of that. It'd be embedded inside of this web page. Node inverts that. But you still need to do this sort of substitution. And so you need a way of specifying that this portion of it is going to change. And you could. I said you could embed this. If you look at the other templating languages that are based more closely on HTML syntax, we have lots of angle brackets and stuff. You can do that. You stick your code in there and you say, oh, I want to have a replicated item here or something, or import this or something. But I find it ugly to look at. So Jade is it's more terse. It's easier to look at. It's easier to see what it's there. But if you look at Express and Node, they support other templating engines. In this class, I'm going to use Jade just because, well, partially because I like it, partially because of default, and we need to stick to one templating engine. And also because then it makes it very clear that you're not writing HTML. So I don't want you to get confused that, oh, here's HTML, here's not. No, you're writing a template, and that will be converted into an HTML document at the end. So the HTML document, so I'm saying resRender, I'm giving it the name of a Jade file, and then I'm giving it an argument. I'm giving it an argument, an object. The object has some number of properties. The properties of that object are variables you can access inside of Jade. Jade runs, in effect, in its own JavaScript scope. It cannot access anything from the rest of your application. It's sandboxed off. You might say, well, that's darn inconvenient. Why can't my templating engine just have access to all the variables from my application? Then I could dynamically generate pages as I wish. If my template, why should it be restricted? You at least have access to the global scope. I mean, Jade, you don't even have access to the global scope. You don't have access to anything except what you pass in. Security concerns. Yes. But why?
It's only Jade has some
Well, what? So what is Jade's reason for being? It's supposed to generate web pages dynamically. Web pages often contain user-generated content. That user-generated content is contained in variables stored on the server, potentially originally in a back-end database. That's then being pulled in and incorporated into a page. So it's possible for that stuff to leak and mess up the rest of the page. And maybe you could, and if you allow it access to the entire state of your web server, it could start changing arbitrary parts of your web server on the fly. And remember, this is JavaScript. It can make it do anything. So very dangerous. So the templating engines are normally isolated, so that when they do their expansion, it's just, it might muck up a page, but it won't do anything else except muck up that page. So I'm saying that inside of the Jade template, so we're calling this Jade template and we're giving it arguments. This is basically, we're parameterizing the template. So here we go to the template, say index.jade. Where are the variables? So there's only one title. And it turns out the way you, there's two ways of incorporating information from a variable passed in into a template in Jade. One is to have a tag. So remember, these are all tags. HTML tags, they're just, this is going to turn into an open bracket H1, close bracket H1. If you say equals in front of it, then whatever you do, whatever you put afterwards is considered to be a variable in Jade. Its contents will be put in, will be put inside of that tag. Say, you want an H1 heading, and whatever the contents of the title variable will be stuck in there. But now let's say I want to mix some amount of values of, okay, here's some static text and here's some stuff from variables. That's when you use this syntax, where you have the pound and the open brace and over there. Because now I can have this name here, colon, which is static, and here's the variable that gets put in. Again, we've got a little thing to figure out here, which is this add template and these index templates. Okay, that's these two files. But what's this layout file? I'm not directly referencing it from JavaScript. Where it's referenced is here. It say extends layout. That's referring to layout.jade. It's saying that I'm not going to code the entire page from scratch here. I'm too lazy. I'm going to use one file that's going to specify the structure of the page. It's going to have all the boilerplate, all the standard stuff that'll go in the web page. That'll be there. And here, I will just extend it. So this is what every web page that we're doing from Jade, you know, in this program are going to basically look like. This is the basic structure. It's going to have a doc type HTML. And then in the HTML portion, we're going to have a head and a body. In the head, we're going to have this block header. In the body, we're going to have this block content. Remember your code academy stuff? What the web page looks like? Here it is. But the pieces here to note are these block things. Everything else is basically static. It's just, well, here's a title. So we're going to use the title that's passed in also as the title of the page. What's the difference between this and this? Right? This is the title that goes in the title bar of the window. Right? This stuff here. That's the title you're setting. That goes in the heading. And then we load in all these scripts, you know, all this JavaScript, the CSS. The block header means that in the Jade code, I can define a block header, and I can also define a block content. Did I define a block header in any of these files? No. So, obviously, that wasn't an error. If you have empty blocks, that's perfectly okay in Jade. But if you want, and in fact, what you may have noticed when you started playing around with this code and started making changes, you'll notice sometimes you might accidentally end up with an empty block. And that's the most likely reason that you can't see anything. So all we do in these pages, we say extends layout, so we load this in, and then we specify what block content is going to contain. When you do J, it is very, very, very important to pay attention to the spacing. J is like Python, but a bit pickier. In particular, it does not like you mixing spaces and tabs. As some of you discovered already in tutorial. For those of you who haven't, this will help you out a little bit. Spaces and tabs do not, if you need to be all spaces or all tabs. I would suggest all spaces. If you're in Emacs and you've got a mix of the two, you can, there's this command untabify, which converts all tabs to the equivalent number of spaces. I suspect there's a similar way to do that in VI. I do not know it. So what spacing does is it's the equivalent of open and close braces in a language like C. It specifies blocks. And so if you want this to be as part of something, it has to be indented. So everything you want to be part of block content has to be indented under block content. The moment you start with something that goes back out flush, you're starting a new thing. So you have to make sure, so it's counting the space. So this is under there, and this is under there. You can leave blank lines, that doesn't reset it. You just can't put anything that'll be flush. And then here, we're passing this div well. So this is a div with a class well. That's how you specify HTML classes or tags, is you just use dot.
What if he makes odd and even numbered spaces for indentation?
It doesn't care about odd versus even. It just cares which is more and which is less.
Okay.
I think you just need one space difference for it to be counted. But I normally do two or three. Yes?
If you remove two spaces from a div well, is everything below div well still a block?
Nope. It's now part of a new block. I mean, it was part of a new thing that was not part of block content. So in fact, if you deleted those two spaces, you would see nothing. Because you didn't specify a block. There's no place for it to fit into the template, and so all of this is basically ignored. So, matters. So, divs here. You know, this is all now, we're specifying this. Now, when I put it on the same line, it's P is just going to fill that in. And then this is all indented underneath it. So, just when you're going through this, you have to play with it. Pay attention to the indentation. Are they also white space sensitive? I didn't.
Like Haskell is white space.
Haskell is. I don't think Ocaml is. Ocaml is okay. But yeah, it's just white. There's a standard term for it, but it's white space sensitive. I mean, all languages are white space sensitive one way or the other. But very sensitive. This is space means block structure. So I could say, oh, you may hate this kind of thing and stuff like that, but actually it isn't that uncommon. There's a lot of other languages that work like this. It's good to learn this. And also it really emphasizes that you're not using the same programming language. So you might say, well, darn it, why don't I just use JavaScript for this? Why do I need a whole different set of syntax? So this is worth typing. But domain specific languages. As a computer scientist, you should understand this concept of domain specific languages, which is a classic way of solving a problem in computer science is to make a language for solving it. You make your vocabulary for solving that problem, and then you solve it in that new language. And the reason you do this is because if you have a new language, it often makes things that were much more complicated easy. So what we have here, Jade, is a domain-specific language. And in fact, this is the way you should always look at programming languages, because once you get to a certain level of power, they're all Turing complete, they can all in principle do everything that everything else does. Fine. That doesn't matter. That doesn't mean they're easy
or the right tool for doing different things. In the web, you will see lots of domain-specific languages. For example, when you do CSS, CSS does not look like HTML. It's a bit different. It's a domain-specific language, a language for specifying how elements of a page look. It's a restricted one. It has its own use. Now, the weird thing about the web is you see all these domain-specific languages embedded in each other. I mean, in a given HTML document, you could have HTML with embedded CSS with embedded JavaScript. Three languages in one document. Remember what I was talking about how HTML, one of the things, it's a compound document? Part of that being compound is it allows for multiple languages inside it to solve different kinds of problems. So you have to get used to this language mode switching. That, oh, I'm talking in this language here, or I'm talking in this language here. And it's, I mean, for those of you who are bilingual, it's like talking in English and French at the same time. You know, based on context, you know what you're talking. Same thing here. So that's why. And in fact, when you're doing a domain-specific language, one question is, how, I know this language already. I know language A. Should I make language B like language A? Or should I make it very different? If you want to make sure you're doing your mode switching cleanly, actually there's a good reason to say they should be very different languages. Because then you can't confuse yourself with going like, oh, this, in which language is this written? The semantics are now unclear. If the domain-specific language has a very different syntax, you know, oh, that's what it is. You can recognize it very fast, and so you can switch. To the computer, it's going to know what language it's in because it's going to be parsing it along. It has very rigid rules for doing this. We don't work that way. We're going to pattern match over the whole source file, over multiple source files, and we've got to figure out what different lines mean. If you can't identify what that line means, you're in trouble. So you got to be able to pick out what that language is instantly. So in that context, the fact that JavaScript looks like Java, looks like C, is very annoying to me because they have such different semantics. But again, history, whatever. So we talked about, so there's a few other things I want to go through in this. What's that? Express.fab icon. You know what fab icons are, right? So you know what a fab icon is? It's this. This little stupid little thing. That little icon there. So if I go to /dot. Where's my fab icon? Come on. At the top? Oh, they put it in there now. Oh, yeah, now they use this for a security indicator. Yeah, this thing that's public versus if I go to. Okay. Yeah, I forgot that. They used to put them there. So there's actually an SSL certificate, which is about to expire, and I'm going to get a new one. But for this, so it's the lock icon's there. It tells you that, yeah, it's GoDaddy. I don't like GoDaddy so much. I'm going to get rid of that. But they were cheap. I think I found one that's cheap as a zero. So. But see, here's the fab icon right here to identify it. You want to set that. Here's the support for the fab icon. I actually haven't looked exactly how it supports that. I haven't tried setting fab icon with Node, but that's what's part of that initial, that thing there. So if you explain the view engine, Jade, the views, this tells you where to get the templates. It's a separate parameter. By default, it's in the views directory, just like this in the public directory. Same pattern here for how we specified it. Mm-hmm.
If by default it's in the views directory, you have the right template.
I think it does default to views in the code, but it's always nice to specify these things, I find. I mean, it depends. I don't know. By default, when Express creates its template, it puts this in there. But yeah, you could delete that line and it wouldn't do anything because, in fact, it does default to views. So we got this, but this is the directory here. Port you've already seen. Oh, one little thing though. What's this env process env port? I think I talked about that.
Any guesses? Yes.
This is referring to environment variables. So in Unix and in Windows, processes have environment variables, which are basic operating system things that are inherited that specify various things about the state. You can set them to change the behavior of processes. In Unix, they're normally things like your path, your terminal type. If I go over to my here and I go, if I type env, here are all my current environment variables. I can do export foo equals bar, and so where'd my foo go? Yeah, I know. I'm just wondering it's in there somewhere. I thought it would like be at the end, but it's not. Or I can do echo $foo. That's the value of foo. So any of these variables you can access in Node. And so what we have here is a little convention that we're going to set. If we set the port environment variable, now maybe you don't want to call it port. Maybe you want to call it node port or my apps port or something else like that. So change it. This is purely in the code, but it defaults to port. So in fact, on my machine, if I try to access port 3000 in my box, it's taken. So every time I run a node app, I say port equals 3040 node app.js. I run that because that will specify that environment variable just for the process that I'm starting. So I can change the port it listens on the. But note that's implemented completely through this line right here. Because I'm setting this port property in the app. Yeah, so this set thing is. There are two gets, which you should keep track of. There's this app get port, and there's this app get slash here. In the code, these are two completely different things. It makes sense from context. If it takes two arguments, you're specifying a route. If it takes one argument, you're accessing a property of the app object.
What's the
or operator? A
parameter.
Not what's the or operator doing?
Yes?
It's a default. What if you don't set the port variable?
So does it mean or?
It does mean
binary.
Or.
It's not binary.
Wait, no, it's. You're saying. No, this is the standard. No. Yeah, it's not. It's a standard OR operator because if its process and port is not defined, it will evaluate to false. And so false, that means that you will have to. If it was true, this is a short circuiting OR. So if it was true, then you don't evaluate this. If it's false, then you evaluate this and you get 3,000. So this is known as a short circuiting Boolean. This is true also in C. So if you have two ands or two ors, it's a way of saying this. Here's a quantity on the left. It will only evaluate as much of it as needed in order to evaluate the truth part of falsehood. But it actually keeps that value.
He means that 3,000 is evaluated,
evaluates
to
true,
then
it
passed true and
hard. It evaluates to 3,000. Yes. So, actually, this is also like C, in which C does not have a Boolean value. It's anything that is not zero is true in C. It's numeric value. So if you have an integer value, if it's zero, it's false. If it's non-zero, it's true. So this is the same thing. But JavaScript has a bit more complicated rules on truthiness or falseness. Because of the types and stuff. So we'll talk about that later, but you mostly can ignore that. But this is kind of like, see, it's, you know, the left, if the left's defined, then you just get that, otherwise you get the right. Yes? Right. Was there a question? Question over here? Yes?
So you always want to use environment for change import. You're never going to hard code it into your JavaScript.
I mean, I can hard code it in. I mean, it just depends on your app. I'm just saying that it's nice having this option there.
Okay.
By having this thing here, that means that you can run multiple instances of your app concurrently without changing the code. Because only one program can listen on a port at any time. So you can run 10 instances of it, different variations, and put in different ports and check them all. Right there, or just different node apps. So this is process import. We got the views, the view engine. We know these requires HTTP is getting the HTTP module. Path is getting for the path parsing. Fab icon. Guess what this does? It logs. It's a logger, which means that when someone types in a request, a request comes into the browser or comes into the server, this is what makes it output those gets and everything. Like, notice when you're running the node server, you get this output on the end of saying gets whatever. That's the line that's generating it. That's the logger. You take that out, or you want to change the format of how it comes out, you just change that line. There's a couple of different options, a couple of different loggers that give in different levels of verbosity or whatever. Or if you just don't want it to log anything, you just get rid of that. If you want it to go to a file, I think you can actually tell it to have this logger, I think, give it an option and say log it to a file. It defaults to standard out, so the console. So express.json, express.url encoded, I forget what method override does. So these are all the JSON and URL encoded. This is what allows you to interpret forms. This is part of the parameter path. So if you send in a JSON object, it'll do that. If you send in URL encoded, which means that if you have options on as part of the URL, as part of the form, we'll talk about these things more. But this is how your form works. If you take out these two lines, posts don't work right. App router, this is the thing that actually gets you to handle the routes here, and then this is the stack. So this development, again, we have another environment variable here. If we have the development variable, it says use this error handler. Node by default goes to development mode. What do you think that error handler is talking about? So by this point, I think all of you have seen error pages that are produced by your application where you get in the browser and you're like, I didn't like that. And it tells you like some line in your program is messed up. That's the line of the application that makes it do that. This, in general, you do not want to do in production. You don't want to tell a particular attacker exactly how they broke your program. That is bad. That tells them all they need for breaking into your program, or at least improving their attack. So when in production, don't return an error page that tells exactly how your program crashed. Log that to a local file and let a sysadmin deal with it, or a developer deal with it later. Don't return it. But when you're doing regular development, it's useful. So that's why it runs there. So what I'm trying to show is that don't ignore any line in this code. You'll do well in this class if you can understand every line of these programs. These programs are not large, but there's a lot of semantics in them. And if you look at the past tests, you look at the assignment stuff, I'm asking you to understand those lines and understand how they fit together. If you're going like, I don't know what that line is, that's okay if you say, I don't know what that line is, but that doesn't mean you should accept that. You should be able to understand every line of these programs, or at least have an idea what everyone does. And that if you took it out, what would break? Exactly how it works, you don't have to know. I don't know exactly how these lines work, because that would require going into the specific module and going down. And you're talking about thousands and thousands of lines of code, and we can't ever understand all that. And that's OK. As a programmer, you have to know how to use things.
not exactly how they work. But you don't know what the lines you're from, why they're there in the part that you're editing, you don't know what's going on.
How can you expect to debug anything? Good. So I think I've actually gone through just, there's one other piece I have to go through is Bootstrap. So if you look at older classes on web stuff, what they used to spend a lot of time on was on teaching HTML, on teaching CSS, trying to go through all the details of how you make web pages. For this class, I said, go do Code Academy. So that at least gets you the basics. After that, I'm saying use things like Bootstrap, which means you don't have to know the details of how to make things all nicely formatted and pretty. I'm not saying that isn't an important skill. It's a very important skill. Now, some of you have design background here. You can have spent a lot of time doing this. It's a whole difficult area. I'm not teaching that. I don't know that stuff. But luckily now on the modern web, you don't have to know all this if you just want to make basic, reasonable-looking web pages. Because there's all these existing systems, packages, for doing this. One of them is Bootstrap. Bootstrap is built off jQuery. First question, where does Bootstrap run? On the client, on the server? Is it run in the browser, or does it run on in Node?
Server, client.
Server, client. It runs on the client, completely in the browser. Very important to realize, it's completely browser side. The only thing that comes from the server is it will give it the files. And it doesn't even have to. Because if you say, look at the getting started, you'll notice that, so you can specify links to style sheets, you can say, let's use this CDN, or let's do this. So what it's saying here, it's saying there's this random web server out there on the internet that is willing to give you this file whenever you ask for it. Should you trust that this web server will always be up and give you that file? And maybe it might just give you some random JavaScript. You don't know. But people take it on faith. They say, they're good people. They're being generous. And so they're serving up things. And so, you don't actually have in your web server have to serve all the components. There's lots of these content distribution networks that can do that, and there are reasons. Like, using a well-known one does have the advantage that if one of your clients has a copy of it already in the browser's cache, they don't have to load it again. So it can save a little bit of time in web page loading. Instead of them loading yet another copy of jQuery, they can just use the one they have lying around because they happen to get the one from Google. But what if that breaks? Now your application breaks because this random web server breaks. Because we're in the lab and our internet connection might be flaky, or you might want to work on this in a disconnected way, not connected to the internet at all, I'm not telling you to load these from the internet on the fly. I'm putting everything so you can do everything locally. You have copies of this. If you're doing this in production, it's a different question. You might say, if people can't get to Google, what does it matter if my app doesn't work? Maybe you, in fact, actually rely on Google for your web application because you're using Google Analytics or because you're doing Google Ads. So maybe it makes sense to, if you're loading stuff, their web servers, they're probably going to be up. Or if they're not up, you don't care about your website being up. But so the browser is, client browser is going to load Bootstrap code into it and evaluate and run it. And there's two portions to it. There is CSS and there's JavaScript. CSS is the styles,
JavaScript is a code to make it
do various things. We'll try using a bit more Java Bootstrap later in the term, but the JavaScript there is running inside the browser. We have not yet written a line of JavaScript that runs in the browser. We have included JavaScript now, but we have not run it. We'll do that soon. But all the JavaScript we've seen up to this point is running on the server side. So why can't something like Bootstrap run inside the server? Why can't it just run all on the server side? Why do I need stuff that's going to run in the client? Remember, the client is where the document object model is, but the document object model is just a representation of the page. The server has the entire page.
Needs to be run by browser engine?
What? Yes and no. I'm saying is, why does it have to run? The server is generating a web page. I've got code running in my server. I've got JavaScript in my server. Why can't I just run everything in the browser in the server side and then just send the output out? It's HTML. And just send it to the client, and then they just got a page. Why am I doing all this running code in the browser stuff? So one thing JavaScript can do in the browser is to adapt to different browsers. So your server just sends up one version, and then JavaScript inspects the browser and says, oh, depending on what kind of browser you are, I'll give you different kinds of content. So there is this new paradigm of designing web pages called responsive design, which the web page looks at its environment and says, how should I format things? Is this a small display? Is this a large display? What capabilities do I have? Let's change the items around. Let's make things from a wide table. Let's make it a listing because we're on a phone, and if you make it really wide, it'd be really annoying to scroll, so we'll make it a long list. These things, or this, and then if it's going to be too long, let's collapse it down into a button that people would have to tap on in order to expand it. To do all that kind of adaptation, you have to run code in the browser. But is that it? Just to make it look pretty? I mean, really, the server could have done that. The server could have just gotten an identifier for the client and then known what the different kind of browser is and then just gone, oh, let me give you a nice custom page. So a basic rule of web applications is that server cycles are relatively expensive compared to client cycles. So if you can offload work to the clients, you're better off. If you offload too much to the clients, then browsers slow down, you get annoying and stuff. But one of the reasons why modern web browsers take up so many resources is because the servers are offloading all kinds of stuff that they could have done themselves onto the browser. But that's not really the fundamental reason. These are all kind of specialized use case things. What's the real reason we aren't just doing everything in the browser? Right? Doing everything in the server? What's this code in the client stuff? Well, we could just have it make a call to the server to update the page. Latency is the reason. Latency is the big reason why you have things running in the browser. You can't do it any other way. It's that every time you make a request to the server, it takes time. You have to send a request, and you have to wait for a response. And we're talking tens of milliseconds to hundreds of milliseconds. And if every time you want the page to change, you have to talk to the server, your web page is going to be very annoying to use, very annoying to interact with. We download code into the browser so as to get around latency issues. And so that the browser can deal with, respond to your mouse clicks, respond to your scroll events, respond to your typing instantaneously, and then do network communication only as needed. Now, this network communication is actually a little bit funny, because sometimes you still have latency issues, such as when you're in Gmail, and you want to access, you know, you're getting one message, and you're going to the next message, you're going to the next message. You'll notice that Gmail in a browser is normally very responsive. You access one email message, then you go to the next message, and it's just there. In fact, it's there so fast, faster than you could expect it if it loaded directly from the server. It's not always that fast, but it's mostly that fast. The reason why it's so fast is because it already loaded it. In the background, it made guesses about what emails it wanted you wanted to read, and it downloaded them in the background, and thus they are right there in the browser when you access it. It's just waiting. It's actually trying to predict you as you use the web application. It's profiling you as you use it in order to improve responsiveness, in order to reduce latency, because it wants to grab those messages while you're reading one, while you're doing something else, because then you're not waiting for it to happen. It all happens in the background, and all of a sudden, magically, it's there for you when you access, when you're ready for it. The browser Chrome is very aggressive about this kind of stuff. You visit a search page in Chrome on Google, you might say, oh, I'm not sure which one I'm gonna access, which is the search result. It loads them all in the background. While you're accessing those search pages, you're trying to figure out which one you want to do, it's just loading them all. And then you click on it, and then of course it's fast because it already loaded it. It loaded a whole bunch of other stuff too, but hey, it loaded the one you wanted. This is one reason Google Chrome in particular has been very bad about distorting web statistics for usage because of all this background loading. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that very insecure? It's always cached. I'm not too familiar with this stuff. Until you always clear the...
Insecure in what sense?
It loads all your emails and can't be requested from you on what page or somehow stolen from you.
So web content, when you have different tabs in a web browser, the browser tries to isolate. These are, in a browser like Chrome, they're actually completely separate processes. But there's lots of mechanisms in all browsers to keep these separate. They're separate JavaScript contexts, they're separate pages. There's lots of rules in the browser to prevent you from accessing these things. So caching stuff, your email there, I mean, it's as secure as you accessing your email to the web in any way. There's a little bit more data, not necessarily huge amounts more data.
It doesn't delete it right after.
You can actually have persistent cache storing. One of the things that HTML5, it can actually store emails locally in your browser. It's part of HTML5 has a local storage option. We're going to store several megabytes worth of storage on a per domain basis. So we have JavaScript running in the client to deal fundamentally with latency issues. It wants to be there to respond to user requests, to do things there. And because JavaScript is there, it's now also used for lots of other purposes, because now you have this general purpose programming engine inside your browser. But it got there because the server cannot do everything, because it cannot provide a responsive interface for all pages. If you just wanted to serve up documents that were static, that'd be one thing. But if you want to serve up something that's going to interact with the user, you need code there to do the interaction. And the server then is just a backend for dealing with the persistent data storage. And that, in fact, is the design of modern web apps, is you actually move most of the code to the client, and the server is just responsible for maintaining data integrity and storing it in databases. And I will stop there.